and welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Stephen. And on this show, we talk about the political economy of speculative fiction and fantasy, which basically means we talk about how decisions get made, how is power distributed, and how is conflict resolved in a given society. And today we have a special guest who writes about and thinks about all of those things very extensively. Welcome to Malka Older.
Thank you for having me.
So, we're talking about, I think, largely about your book, Infomocracy. Is it the Infomocracy trilogy or the Sentinel trilogy? What does it?
Officially, it's the Sentinel cycle. So okay. It's Infomocracy, Null States, and State Tectonics.
And these were published in the last 5 years?
Infomocracy was 2016 summer, and then they were each year after that, 2017, 2018.
Right. So kind of coincided with the dawn of the Trump era, like very.
Yeah. So can you give us just like an overview of what the books are about?
Sure. So the books take place, they're science fiction political thrillers. They take place about 60 years from now in a future in which the nation state is largely defunct, although there are a couple of holdouts that kind of try to keep going in that way. But most of the world is under a system that I call micro-democracy, in which the basic jurisdictional unit is what's called a sentinel of 100,000 people. And because it's population-based as opposed to territory-based, 100,000 people could be a couple of really dense city blocks, or it could be just wide swaths of rural area. And each of those sentinels can vote for any government that it wants out of all the governments that exist in the world at this time, which is roughly 2,000, let's say, some of which are very local and maybe only hold a couple of sentinels and are really focused on their local issues, and some of which are global and might have sentinels and therefore constituents all over the world in these scattered pockets. So basically, you can be walking down a city street and change governments as you cross the street. And if you're a government, you could have people that you're responsible for all over the world. And this whole system is facilitated by a large international organization, sort of a UN Google cross, that's entirely dedicated to information management, which I very creatively named Information. And so it's basically, a huge bureaucracy of a lot of employees that's just there to try and make sure that everyone has access to information that they need, and that the information is as correct as they can get it or as complete as they can get it. And it's pretty proactive about this. So it's not just making the information available. It's occasionally kind of pushing it a little bit into people's faces. Definitely checking in on things that are inaccurate or lies, and working on the principle that sort of that information is a really fundamental part of this democratic system.
I really liked about Information that it has the makings of like a dystopic authoritarian organization. It has all those trappings of like it's watching basically everybody all the time, and it has the potential to just like put out propaganda all the time, but it's actually none of those things. It's like it's purely for the benefit of everyone who has it.
Which is kind of a dangerous thing to say, because it's easy for propaganda arms to say that they're purely for the benefit of everyone. But there is Information does get compared to that sort of entity quite a lot, and justifiably so. But there is this really important distinction to it, which is that, most of the times that we think about both propaganda and surveillance organisms, they're holding the information, they're sequestering the information themselves. And in this case, the whole point is to get the information out to everybody. So, when I talk about it, when people ask me about this, I tend to feel like the degree of surveillance and also, let's say, information massaging, if you want to call it that, is really not much higher than what we have today. But it's, instead of being a patchwork of corporations that are doing the surveillance the way it happens in the US, or a government that's doing the surveillance as happens in a lot of places, it's this other organization, and it's trying to get all of that out public to everybody. And it's a very scary thought to think of having all the surveillance and having it be open and public. To me personally, it's less scary than to have all that surveillance and not know what the data is that's been collected, who's using it, how it's being used. So I'm definitely not trying to promote this as a perfect system or even necessarily a good system. I'm trying to use it very much as a way of looking at our system. That's, you know, I'm really talking about today. But I don't see it as dystopian in the ways that a lot of people do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even if you look in the book, it doesn't work as advertised in the course of the
course. And that's part of really what is reflective of today. I wanted to test out this system that was different, but keep it in a world where humans are flawed and power grabbing and so on. And I wanted to also show that, you know, our systems today don't work as advertised.
I mean, even if somebody is subscribed to every news channel that they can and watch all of them, there's lots of information that those people have that they've filtered out and chosen not to share.
Of course. Of course. And so one of the big principles behind information is that they've kind of given up on the idea of neutrality, that it's not possible for humans to be neutral, and there is no actual neutral either when it comes to these questions. And so instead, the principle that they have to replace it is transparency. So instead of trying to find a neutral way of reporting things, they try to put everything out there and also be very clear about the ways that they are triaging it. If there's data, they try to have all the layers of where that data comes from and how it's been interpreted. It doesn't work perfectly. One of the problems is that, a lot of the people that they're trying to get this information to really just don't care enough to deal, or just hate the idea of a massive organization in any case, and particularly one dealing with information. It doesn't work perfectly, but it's an attempt. And I think, the reason I do think the books are quite hopeful is that we do have to keep trying to do things better because they're not going very well right now.
Yeah, absolutely. When we read them, I think we were also thinking about sort of like the disparity now that exists, that like if you're wealthy in our world, you often have access to a lot of things that people who are not. Like the poor of the world just don't have a lot of access to things that give them information, And so information sort of trying to be that equalizer of like, it doesn't matter really who you are. You should have this basic access to like know what you want to know about the world.
Yeah. I do believe that information is a public good, particularly in the world as it stands now. So it's, one thing is about individuals, but another thing is, in terms of making all the other goods and services that we depend on, that we want, run smoothly, information is kind of an underpinning element to that. And I do think it should be treated as a public good in the same way that we treat, electricity and transportation as public goods. There's a lot more benefit for the society to be gained than the immediate benefit to individual people.
Mm-hmm. And I think the COVID-19 crisis is a really like salient example of that, right? The better information can flow, the better it can be handled. And the more it's disrupted, I think kind of the worse things get. And I think, people in the U.S. and Canada, we've been seeing a lot of protests from people saying this either doesn't exist or is, or is simultaneously a bioweapon or something. I don't follow it completely. But this notion that this is, I think, a really classic example. Like we have the level of discourse is wildly disproportionate and is really divided on sectarian lines in a lot of ways, right? Not religiously sectarian, but
I get you. Yeah, it's true. And it does show how dangerous it is. I think it's also a good example of showing part of the difficulty, because today the information that we deal with on a daily basis, but particularly trying to make political decisions, is often information that we cannot access directly, right? To take the example of this pandemic, we can't, it would certainly be ill-advised to go to the places that are worst hit and look at what's going on. Most of us don't have the science training to understand. Actually, no one fully understands it right now. It's in process of being explored. So, there's a lot of uncertainty. And those are the circumstances where we have to choose proxies. We have to choose people or organizations to depend on to get our information from, because we can't know. And yeah, the pandemic is a particularly striking example of that. But a lot of the stuff that we talk about is very similar. We talk about stuff that's happening in other places. We talk about statistics or even just very large numbers, like the number of unemployed people, is not something that we can find out about directly. And so there's this tension, I think, between these vast and abstract types of information that we're supposed to deal with every day, and then sort of the information we come in contact with directly, which is anecdotal, I have a sociology degree. I did a qualitative dissertation. So I have a lot of respect for anecdotal information. But it does get run down a lot as something that's not true, you know, and it is limited. And so there's really this tension of, you know, when you have that gap between what people can know for themselves and what they need to know to make informed decisions, there's space for problems.
I've volunteered on numerous political campaigns, and I go out and talk to people on their doorsteps about the importance of the election and why I think my party should be elected. And I have people who say, oh, well, you know, I want a party that's going to reduce our taxes because the province we live in has the highest taxes. And I say demonstrably that is false. That is like actually not true. Alberta has the lowest taxes in the country. And they say, no, that's not what I've heard. Well, no, but that's the fact of it is that. No, I disagree with you.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal. And this was really, for me, this is a large part of the inspiration for writing the book, was that, you know, I used to have these arguments with people that I disagreed with who were on the opposite end of the political spectrum. Maybe opposite is too strong. The people who were on the other end, you know, across the line, let's say, of the political spectrum, if not all the way at the other end. And we would have these great discussions about, you know, why we believe different things and why we thought one economic policy was better than another and why we thought one social policy was important or wasn't. They were really good discussions, and they definitely taught me more about what I believe, as well as understanding better what other people believe. And at some point, it started to get really difficult to do that, because while we could disagree in a way that was useful about principles or even, you know, what we can call ideology, once we didn't have the same facts to discuss, you know, once someone would say something and be like, no, that's not true, and they would say, but yours isn't true. And, you know, I certainly had more trust in my sources than in their sources. But at the same time, I know that I'm getting it from sources. And it's very hard to find a way to say no. I mean, I think the taxes is one of the easier examples. And still, how can you convince people, you know? And so it's you know, I found it very, very frustrating and disturbing to not even be able to have profitable disagreements with people about these principles, because we just couldn't find a leg to stand on. We couldn't find firm ground from which to have that argument. It's pretty terrifying. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was kind of the genesis of information, was to say, I need some source that I can point to and that will tell me yes, no, or we don't know. And here's everything why. Because even, you know, I could say if I wanted to argue unemployment numbers with someone, I can go and look up the studies, but they're hard to find and then they're hard to understand. So I had this idea. I wanted to have this adult in the room of information management. And of course, as soon as I had the idea, I thought this is a terrible idea, because if there is an authority that everyone can agree on, if that authority gets corrupted, you're really screwed. But I was interested enough to want to play it out through the three books, as it turned out. I initially was just going to write one on this. And it was, you know, it was a really, really interesting practice to go through.
Cool. So yeah, I think that's a very interesting origin story. So for us, we being the type of podcast we are, we're just like, really like to get really nerdy on some stuff, get really deep mm-hmm. into it. So I might ask you some questions, understanding that, of course, obviously maybe some of these are not fair. just in the broad sense of, you know, we're kind of just because we want to do the exercise, run through it. Like if this was happening, what would it look like?
I mean, if you've read my book, you know I'm incredibly nerdy.
Okay.
That said, I'm also perfectly happy to say I don't know.
That's great. Okay, wonderful. Because, yeah, because I think we always think about money. What's going on with money? The Sentinel system and money. Because like one of the things is like, so if you want to have like, I think there's an example of like a Maoist Sentinel, right? Mm. But if you're going to be one of the things you need to have to be like a Maoist, like a lot of types of communist or economies is you need to have fiat currency control, because a lot of your or even actually an aggressive neoliberal on the other side, like Ronald Reagan couldn't exist without money supply control. So like if you have an economic planning philosophy in your politics, how do you do currency and how do you engage with money? Is there a global currency? Do they have sentinel? Like, do you need to change your money when you walk down the street? Like, what happens?
Yeah, I gotta say, I slightly fudged the money thing on this one because I didn't want to get too hung up on it. So I just kind of went with a global currency that's basically administered by information in a very, very, very loose sense of administered. Because I think it is, I don't know, I have feelings about macroeconomic policy. I think that it's vastly overstated, both what we know about it and what it can do. And so, while the main reason that there's a simple, almost not mentioned global currency in the books is that it was easier for me to deal with, there's also a certain sense in which I don't really think we need to be messing around with this stuff quite as much as we do. And I think, you know, a lot of it is there for arbitrage purposes, basically. That's not a big principle of mine, but the macroeconomists don't know as much as they claim to know is something that I will stand by, having studied some macroeconomics and just looking at the world. But I am not saying that arbitrage is terrible or that having central banks to deal with things is terrible, but I'm not sure it's as necessary as we pretend these days.
I think that's a beautiful answer. I like it.
I was consciously in when I was writing the first book, and at some point I talk about money, I think, when there's the information blackout and what happens to money at that point. But I was consciously kind of like, I can't go into too much detail on this, because it's just too much. But, you know, clearly, I mean, you could have different currencies because of the smoothness of information transfer in this world. It wouldn't be that hard to have your money just automatically transfer as you cross borders, but it also seems a bit excessive and silly to do that in order to have different economic policy over a sentinel of 100,000 people.
Well, for a marketplace.
To try to deal with macroeconomic policy over sentinels that are in very different places and might have very different economies.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because some of these sentinels are going to be, you know, like resource poor or manufacturer, like they won't have the industry. So then, you know, if there was a global market of currencies, yeah, it would be super messy. And then if you change governments and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I have a different currency now, the situation of my sentinel hasn't materially changed, but all of a sudden my currency is completely different.
Yeah, it's a lot. And again, it might be sort of a change with no change if you're thinking about if it's all electronic currency anyway, and it just sort of switches name. But then again, why bother? So I do think a lot about the economic implications of this world and sort of things like, you know, I think I mentioned in some places, you know, long haul travel has become really difficult because you have to cross so many jurisdictions, and there's sort of some treaties that are standard between governments wherever the sentinels are, in terms of the sentinels having very different needs. I do hint at one point that particularly with some of the less scrupulous governments, they may have sentinels within their governments that get very different treatment depending on whether they're producers or consumers. So I did think quite a bit about the economics, somewhat less about the currency and the monetary policy.
There's a lot more to economics than money. It's not the be all end all it's made out to be. And I think this is proving it. I think in a lot of ways, our current situation is really proving how the money can come into conflict with the reality of the situation.
Right. So you were talking about like the relationships between the different sentinels and like treaties between them. Is there what sort of role is there for like the supermajority to act kind of like a federal government? Because like I think about like Canada being like, you know, we have our provinces and territories, but then the federal government has like areas of jurisdiction that they say, okay, well, like you have to provide at least this level of healthcare to everybody.
I don't know. Have you read the sequels yet?
Yeah, we've read all three.
Yeah.
Okay, because it becomes a bit clearer in the sequels, but the supermajority is a really terrible misnomer, which again, I'm totally responsible for. But it has very little power, really, over other Sentinels. There's a very strong autonomy for Sentinel governments and for governments that cover multiple Sentinels. But the supermajority does have some say in sort of the overall process rules, which they negotiate with information. And so it's really not very federal, except in the sense maybe of information itself, which is not elected and doesn't directly control stuff, but does. Information is really where that most of that umbrella sort of stuff would happen. So the supermajority people really want it. It's got kind of a momentum thing going. You know, if you're the supermajority, it's a name recognition thing. People are maybe more likely to vote for you. You get a certain amount of power, and you do get a certain amount of say in overall issues, process issues, but not very much at all on how the other Sentinels govern themselves.
So then how do they handle like global problems that require cooperation? So something like whether that's climate change or a crisis that comes up.
One of the things I had to add in the third book, because I did an event for NASA with space exploration.
Yeah.
Which doesn't necessarily require cooperation if there's some large and rich governments, but there's a lot of reasons to have cooperation, and really information is the one that moderates all of that. And in the third book particularly, there's some mention of kind of overarching issues in terms of decisions about where the lines are on human rights and where the lines are on environmental policies. And so you can see over the course of this this system, kind of a movement towards more cooperation and more influence of information on umbrella policies. So that does happen. I think, you know, at the beginning, when they first shift to this system, it's very much kind of, this is our new form of democracy. Each place gets to pick what they want. And, you know, information is there to facilitate that democracy, to facilitate, relations between them, but also especially how the elections happen and how we make, make this work. And over the course of the system, it becomes much more, okay, there are things that we need to align ourselves on.
Mm-hmm. Like the mantle tunnel, I guess.
Yes.
Spoilers. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I mean, I think questions about things like, and you know, it says as well that part of the appeal of the mantle tunnel for people is that because it goes underground, it doesn't pass through Sentinels, so there's less jurisdictional stuff to deal with than on, say, a railroad. There are these. You know, there's clearly a system of courts or judgments mostly by information. And again, you know, I wanted to have a system that was, it's when we start the first book, it's been 20 years. So it's been around for a little while, but it's still a pretty young system. Mm-hmm. And they're still working out a lot of the difficulties and trying to figure out, you know, how to make it function better. I like to remind people that nation states are still a pretty young system too, even though they seem like it's the inevitable way for things to be. It's very much not.
So, okay. This jurisdiction then, how does that affect mobility and citizenship?
So, sorry, you said mobility and
citizenship. Like if you want to live somewhere, because if you're walking through a city and the Sentinel changes, but you're like, oh, but I, you know, I like that house over there. I'd rather live there.
Right. So this is another area where each government can decide for itself. They can decide what their citizenship requirements are. They can decide how they feel about immigration. So they can, in fact, close off a government or all their sentinels to immigration if they would like. However, because, and there are probably some that do, but because the system is based on population as opposed to territory, the incentives are all towards having more immigration. Mm-hmm. So if you have a lovely sentinel of 100,000 people, give or take, and you manage to get another 100,000 people to move in there during the 10 years between elections, suddenly you have two sentinels in the same space. And you know, if they're all happy, they're all voting for your government. And suddenly, you know, you get bingo, an extra point for your count towards the supermajority. So mostly immigration is quite free because of these incentives. In terms of citizenship, again, you know, that's up to each sentinel. And I can imagine a really wide range of, up to each government, sorry, not each sentinel, a really wide range of solutions for how that can work out. But certainly, you know, you could conceivably be walking down the street and have to go around a sentinel that wouldn't let people in, or go around a sentinel that had some sort of antipathy to your particular citizenship. In terms of this idea of, you know, you go somewhere to see a house, you're like, that's true now too. You know, I mean, how often do you go on vacation? And you're like, gosh, I would love to move here. And you can't because you're not wealthy enough to invest $500,000 in the economy of that country or whatever they like, or because, you know, their government does not want people to move in from your particular country or your particular ethnicity. And, you know, I really dislike borders. I really like communities and differences and seeing places that have evolved differently over time. But I really dislike borders, and I really am skeptical of the idea. Well, skeptical. I think, you know, citizenship has become this tool almost feudal in the way that we're tied to it. And it doesn't have to be that way. There's so many different ways we could structure citizenship that would be, you know, better for the country's economy and better in just all kinds of ways for everyone concerned. And unfortunately, it's just being used as a power tool. So,
well, and citizenship is also one of those things that is in its current iteration is a pretty new thing, right? Like,
oh yeah,
even like grandparents or great grandparents could have crossed borders, moved to a different country without ever like immigrating. They just like moved to a different spot and lived there, and then someone was like, oh yeah, well, you live here, you're a citizen.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the nation state thing, and you know, I like to think of it as a step in our evolution towards something better. I try to think of it this way, because you know, we did move from a certain way of thinking about how people belong to a group to a different way of thinking, and nationality can be, not always, but it can be more separated, sorry, from just conditions of birth. You know, it's not something that is necessarily dependent on where you're born and who your parents are. The way that the color of your skin is, or your religion can be, or your mother tongue can be. That said, we've done a lot to make nationality dependent on those things, and that's a shame. But it does have the potential to be quite different, and we can help, or we could have a new system instead.
Yeah, well, to me, it seems like citizenship is increasingly being used as a way to skirt enfranchisement. Like, it's the new enfranchisement, right? So you can, like, you ostensibly on the books have this law where it says, you know, universal franchise, except not the citizens. Well, sometimes your citizenship criteria can start to look a lot like a criteria for enfranchisement in their society. So.
Oh yeah, of course. Or second class citizenship in all sorts of other ways. I mean, you know, in the U.S., it's, you know, they're obviously a hugely tangled thing, but you know, part of the reason that there is as much undocumented immigration as there is not because it's impossible to stop, but because it provides an entire class of people who work cheaper.
Yep.
Because if they wanted to stop it, the way to stop it would be by addressing the employers instead of trying an enormous border. And you know, it's just a way of dividing people into a different class of people who can be paid less and do different jobs. And it's pretty horrible. Like I said, you know, it's very related to some of the ideas of feudalism and racism and all sorts of other things. Yeah. So it's terrible, and we should change it.
We absolutely should. And so Canada, I think the law went into effect that if you have dual citizenship, when you commit a crime, they can revoke your Canadian citizenship and just deport you to that other country, which is really sort of like a terrifying thing for immigrants who come in, and they're like, there were people who had lived in Canada their entire life didn't know that they technically had citizenship somewhere else, and then had like were just removed from Canadian society and like sent to other countries where they had no like social network or anything, and they were just like, well, sometimes you're a citizen there, so we can wash our hands of this.
Yeah, that's pretty terrible for all sorts of reasons. And I'd be much more okay with it if, you know, people who were single citizens could also get deported, because after all, exile is a hallowed form of punishment. I don't really think it should be used, because if nothing else, it's kind of like shunting off your problems to another country that doesn't want to deal with them. But like to have that distinction is basically saying that, you know, some citizens are more than others. And that, again, is a way of creating another class that's more vulnerable and that therefore can be exploited.
So how does microdemocracy deal with things like tax havens? Like if there's a government that gets elected and says, if you shelter your money here, we won't pay, you know, the like a full rate to information or something like that.
Yeah, we invented a fictional sentinel called the Greater Mercantilism of Upper Wall Street, and there they have no they are a libertarian paradise, no taxation, no tariff, no financial transaction, no Tobin tax, nothing like that.
I think that that's a bit less likely to occur because so many of the large governments, particularly, but also smaller ones, are corporations, and that they therefore set up their own. I mean, they basically just make their own governments a tax haven. They, you know, they can set it up exactly as they like. Anyway, it's not impossible that they would be governments that perform this service for smaller companies. I can certainly see that being something that would be put out, but that would be in terms of sort of government level taxes, right? So a government would just be like, okay, our founding corporations, they obviously don't pay any taxes. We get all our taxes from other corporations and citizens. But in terms of dues to infomocracy and to information, in terms of supporting information itself and that infrastructure, yeah, I think if you want to belong to the system, you have to pay those dues into it. I don't think they're particularly high or onerous, because I don't go into a lot of detail about how information was started, but there is a bit about it in the first book that says it comes out of a couple of civil action suits about basically one is, I guess, Diet Soda, the alliance of people for many years, and the other is against the 24-hour news channel, same. And so the sort of beginning of this was that there are these huge settlements that then got put into trust, and were so that this money was used to create the initial infrastructure, but also it's in trust, so that there's an interest that's coming out. I do think that there are dues that the governments do have to pay, but especially considering that, yeah, I think that it's not a huge amount. I'm sure there are still governments that rail against it, but you know, if you want access to the information superhighway, you have to pay up.
This has been fantastic. One last question I do have, though, before we go on any further. Mm-hmm. What is a crow?
Yeah, I get asked about this a lot. So the question is,
like, is it a blimp? Is it? yeah. And how far are we from actually having them? Because they sound fantastic.
Yeah. You know, I always have rated the things that I would like to see happen from the book. First the lumper, then yes, the crow. And now I just realized I did a reading last night and I have a whole new appreciation for the crowd cutter in these fraught days.
I don't remember the crowd cutter.
Oh, it's right in the first chapter of the book, although it's mentioned again in the third. But it's basically like this transparent vinyl shell shaped like a shark fin that lets you get through crowds easily. It would also work pretty well for social distancing.
Yes.
But yeah, the crows, basically, you know, when I started writing the book, I was flying a lot. I worked for an international organization and I was a global staff person. So I just did a really incredible number of long haul flights in the 11 months that I worked there. And I just wanted something different. So it's like a huge amount of wishful thinking on my part, in terms of, you know, both sort of having my own space and having a very different mode of travel. And I don't go into too many details on it. But I will say that if I had to come up with an image of it, I think a lot about the description of the Heart of Gold in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is like a sleek white running shoe. So, you know, something along those lines.
Nice.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We really enjoyed the books, and we very much enjoyed our conversation with you. Thank you for taking time. I know you have an anthology you recently put out called And Other Disasters. I really encourage people to check that out.
Thank you. Yeah.
Is there anything
it's
else
available? Sorry, go ahead.
No, please say where it's available. Yeah.
Well, it's available everywhere that you buy books, but also directly from the publishers, which is Mason Jar Press. And it's available in ebook as well as print.
Okay. Yeah. So fantastic. We are very excited to see what you put out next. And is there anything else you're working on or interested in or want to share with people?
So I do write for Serial Box quite a lot. And I have a number of serials there that I've worked on, including the Orphan Black sequel, as well as a bunch of originals. One that I created, which is called Ninth Step Station, which is currently in its second season. And it's a lot of fun. It's a near future Tokyo buddy cop procedural murder mystery series. We just have a ball writing it. And people seem to enjoy reading it. So definitely check that out. And as we mentioned, the trilogy, the collection, if you go to my website, which is on WordPress, you can find links to all my publications, and quite a lot of the short stories or poems are available for free online. So as well as essays and other things that I've written. So that's a good place to start out.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. And we enjoyed this meditation on democracy and power asymmetry in society. We thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, thank you. Those were great questions. And it's really great to talk to nerds about this stuff that I'm extremely nerdy about. So thank you.
Wonderful. Have a great day.
You too.
And if you enjoyed this program and you want to get more Androids and Assets political science, science fiction hybrid content, you should definitely follow us on Twitter at AssetDroid or on Instagram also at AssetDroid. And if you want to get in touch with Marshall or myself, we both have email addresses. Marshall, what's your email?
I am Marshall, MARSHALL at androidsandassets.ca.
And I am Steve, STEVESTEVE at androidsandassets.ca.
You can also find me on Twitter. I'm Econo Boyd.
And I'm Steve Droids. And our website is androidsandassets.ca. So yeah, so next time you're, having a beer with people and you're talking about like divisive political issues, please, say, well, maybe you should listen to this podcast called Androids and Assets. We really appreciate your support. We would love to have more people listening, and we would always appreciate any sort of shares or comments or star ratings on any of the platforms. Particularly Apple Podcasts is a big one for us. We are ever so grateful to you for listening, and we hope you have a wonderful and very democratic day.